ask for voluntary power conservation during evening hours. Elsewhere, a forest fire started during lightning storms in southeast Washington, and it grew to 86 square miles or 223 square kilometers. It was 20% contained on Monday. Another wildfire west of Winthrop closed the scenic North Cascades Highway, the most northern route through the Cascade Range. The road provides access to North Cascades National Park and the Ross Lake National Recreation Area. In Idaho, the National Guard has been mobilized to help fight twin lightning spark fires that have together charred nearly 24 square miles or 60 square kilometers of dry timber in the remote drought-stricken region. In total, there are 67 active large fires in western United States, which have burned more than 1,434 square miles of land, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. More than 14,200 wildland firefighters, as well as support personnel, are assigned to fire incidents, according to the center. There has been a dramatic increase year to date in 2021 compared to previous year 2020. From 1st of January to 13th of July of 2021, there have been 33,953 fires compared with 27,770 fires in the same period of 2020, according to the National Interagency Fire Center. The July heat wave follows an unusual June siege of broiling temperatures in the west and comes amid worsening drought conditions throughout the region. Scientists say human-caused climate breakdown and decades of fire suppression that increases fuel loads have aggravated fire conditions across the region.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Dark Review with me, Camelia Shambayaki. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black community. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Grenada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a US military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me as the bombs dropped and the island shook. You said this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
The shooting! The shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world, forward ever, backward never.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, in the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, when she was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But he does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life and black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And we see like trove of sort of documentaries coming out about black power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance, and I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. It also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative, and it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora of that home, that place, that belonging, and wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada, and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You've sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will like. Those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That's a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counter. Because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. He went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Demani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic because I found it really interesting the way his documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterwards, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisers to raise U.S. prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The US perceived this as a threat?
The US perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left, not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the region.
Hello, my name is Demani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Demani Baker there himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Demani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Demani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls and how come that he, as a young filmmaker, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies.
Even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot it, if you like, a sort of straight line. How do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles? How do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And the archive, I think, is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. I think it speaks to that broader narrative, and within that there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me actually of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that actually the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Granada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'd like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in pre-Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful militant revolution. My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the, not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government. A revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
With legendary activist Angela Davis, world renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Granada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, and he was tragically later shot dead, said if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this, a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the most horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least stumble, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated the very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world, responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda, and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and then, you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a sort of kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration. And you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Resonates a lot with today.
I think so. And you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today, with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
Not naming any names.
No.
We'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night. It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States.
That was not an environment to raise children. A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny Damani Baker's mother was a student of hers at the UCLA, yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life, and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life, or racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide, continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world, and quite rightly so when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking the loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline. And she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time, the 80s, organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realize just how far we've got to come. People have to realize when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And on comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And right, though, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much treatment, cinematic treatment, of the events in Grenada. So to have a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, then, would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism, in the name of God, salam, and welcome to the second episode of our series Health Tourism. In the last episode, we discussed various types of tourism and learned that medical tourism is one form of tourism which is growing significantly year after year. Many people travel to other countries with the aim of receiving quality medical services at a cheaper and more reasonable cost than they would at home. Please stay with us for a more detailed discussion of medical tourism. Tourism is the result of combining two profitable industries, that is, travel and medical industries. Therefore, this kind of tourism also includes a variety of subcategories, such as medical tourism, curative tourism, and wellness tourism. All of them are named based on patients' needs. Considering a variety of definitions with regard to health tourism, we tend to mention all as health tourism, and our focus will be mainly on familiarizing patients with medical centers and services provided in the Islamic Republic of Iran. to increase their revenues, many countries all around the world are keen to offer medical services. However, due to the critical nature of this field and the lack of required medical infrastructure and experienced professionals, not all countries are able to do so. Among all countries, Iran is considered one of the best in offering medical services to foreign nationals. Benefiting from various eye-catching historical sites and stunning nature, the country attracts a huge number of tourists who come to enjoy Iran's tourist attractions every year. According to reports, Iran ranks 10th globally on the list of world's historical sites and 5th in terms of natural attractions. Besides that, Iran has become one of the pioneering countries in the region and the world, thanks to its scientific development in the field of medicine, excellent and highly trained doctors, as well as utilizing state-of-the-art facilities, which has made this country a popular destination for medical tourists, especially those tourists and patients who visit Iran from neighboring countries. Nowadays, many patients from regional countries such as Kuwait, Qatar, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and so on, prefer to travel to Iran instead of European countries to get medical services. The close distance between Iran and neighboring countries enables patients to go back in a short time after receiving excellent treatments from Iranian professionals and doctors and their brilliant expertise. Another reason is the reasonable cost of treatment in Iran that has made this country a popular destination for patients. The special attention from Iran's neighboring countries, as well as Iranian doctors' expertise and qualifications, has encouraged Iran's health ministry to launch a special department called Department of Health Tourism of Ministry of Health to facilitate health tourism for those in need and adopt rules and regulations for hospitals admitting foreign patients. According to these regulations, hospitals, clinics, and other medical centers with foreign applicants are required to launch International Patient Department, or IPD. Otherwise, they are not allowed to admit foreign patients unless in emergency situation. Medical centers with IPD permit are required to follow related instructions. Those hospitals with IPD permit should undertake few tasks, such as doing needed coordination for admitting patients, accompanying them during their stay in Iran, offering medical services and recovery cures after their surgery, and all sort of services patients need throughout their stay in the country. The IPD staff are responsible for responding patients' application and contacting them via phone and email and holding conference with their attending physician. Patients can easily contact IPD of each hospital to know more about the costs and services of treatment they offer beforehand. Also, the IPD staff are in charge of doing essential coordination with doctors and hospitals, coordination with surgery rooms, care unit, discharge and finance units. Currently, there are more than 150 hospitals and medical centers in Tehran and other Iranian cities with special permit for treating foreign patients. Iran is one of the countries in the world with high expertise in treating cardiovascular diseases, infertility, ophthalmic and neurological disorders, as well as treating different cancers. Iran also benefits from a high reputation in the region in the field of plastic surgery. Also, the country ranks first in Asia and third in the world in kidney transplant with laparoscopy, and according to a 2019 report, ranks first in the world in liver transplant. Iranian optometrists are among high-ranking experts in the world, and the facilities being utilized in some optometry centers in Iran are the best ones that are being used in only a few countries in the world. Most of the foreign patients in Iranian hospitals have been respectively admitted for female diseases, cardiovascular diseases, nose job, eye surgery, and general surgeries. The Iranian cities of Tehran, Qom, Mashhad, Ahvaz, Urumiye, and Shiraz have received most of the foreign patients. Patients and medical tourists can receive more information about hospitals and medical centers with IPD permit in various ways. One of them is the Iran Ministry of Health Medical Tourism Department. Its website is iht.en.behdasht.gov.ir. By a quick browse in this website, you can get information you need about the hospital and medical centers in Iran with IPD permit, the rules and regulations, as well as tourism in Iran and Iranian hotels in different languages. Iran's health ministry has also announced that it will issue permits to those qualified tourism centers and institutes that are willing to work in the field of health tourism. These centers are ready to offer various types of services to medical tourists, and they can trustfully assign these centers the coordination job with the hospitals and let them reserve the hotel. To know more about these centers and institutes, the applicants can easily go to Iran's Health Ministry website. Also, many of these institutes have branches in many countries where the patients can ask them for more information in person. Dear listeners, this was the second episode of our program, Health Tourism. In the next episode, we will introduce one of reputable optometry hospitals in the Iranian capital, Tehran, called Farabi Hospital. Till next program, goodbye.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. Asserting the rights of the people is an important responsibility for the judiciary branch. The second point is the issue of the involvement of the judiciary in the assertion of public rights, which previously showed itself in the issue of pursuing production and the factories that were shut down. Of course, it showed itself in other areas as well, such as banning the use of certain natural resources and governmental lands and the like, this is a very necessary and good measure. If some people say that this is not within the scope of the responsibilities of the judiciary branch, this is a completely false statement, and it is against what the law says. Involvement in the assertion of public rights is an important responsibility of the judiciary branch. It is one of the duties of public prosecutors. They should be careful and vigilant, so should the whole branch, as this is a very important task. Of course, public rights are not confined to economic matters. Health, education, the environment, and the like are other issues in the domain of public rights. Supporting those who counsel to do good and who advise against evil. One example of public right is the counsel to do good and the advice against evil. Of course, this wajib, religiously obligatory act is not common in our society the way it should be. Those who counsel to do good and advise against evil should not be left alone. Rather, they should be supported. Of course, I know there are some people who kick up a fuss in the name of counsel to do good and advice against evil with some ulterior motives. Very well. Who should distinguish between real and fake counselors to do good and advisers against evil? It is up to the judiciary to distinguish this. You should back up those whom you understand are real counselors to do good and advisers against evil. As I was told, there is a legal gap regarding the issue of pursuing public rights as well. Now, for example, what is the sentence of a person who has violated public rights? What is the punishment? This is not specified in law. Therefore, different judicial systems in different cities and different parts of the country obviously have to behave according to their personal views. One gives a certain ruling and another gives a different one. Laws are needed for this as well. This was another point. Alhamdulillah, alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
limelight.
Coronavirus cases are rising in several American states like Nevada, where vaccinations lag and the Delta variant is spreading. It now accounts for half of U.S. cases. We now present you an article written by Victoria Bekempis under the heading, COVID outbreak among vaccinated Vegas hospital workers underscores Delta risks. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Outbreak of COVID-19 among vaccinated staffers at a Las Vegas hospital has highlighted the risk posed by the Delta variant of the virus in the United States, as Nevada struggles with rising COVID cases and stagnating vaccination rates. Hospital officials confirmed to The Guardian 11 workers at the Sunrise Hospital and Medical Center, only one of whom was unvaccinated, tested positive for coronavirus after attending a party in early June. Sunrise's Chief Executive Officer, Todd Sklumberg, said in a statement, the Center for Disease Control, the CDC, has confirmed that 11 of our colleagues at Sunrise Hospital tested positive for the COVID-19 Delta variant, claiming all who tested positive are doing well and have returned to work. The Chief Executive Officer of Sunrise, Todd Sklumberg, added, "We want to acknowledge our colleagues recognized their own symptoms, similar to allergies or the common cold, and chose to get tested. There were no exposures to our patients, and our staff complies with all personal protection equipment guidelines, masking at all times and wearing face shields with all patient encounters." The outbreak, first reported by the Las Vegas Review-Journal, comes amid growing concern in the United States about the Delta variant of the coronavirus, which is now the dominant variant in the country. Because the Delta variant is highly transmissible, authorities have said it's all the more important for unvaccinated people to get their shots, both for personal immunity reasons and to prevent spreading COVID-19 to others. The variant is now being blamed for surges in southern Missouri and northern Arkansas, now the largest U.S. outbreak of new COVID cases. According to the National Public Radio, NPR, authorities have warned that it will only worsen if vaccination rates continue to languish in these areas. While there have been breakthrough cases, health officials have repeatedly claimed that vaccinations provide strong protection, including against the Delta variant of the coronavirus. U.S. authorities claim COVID-19 vaccines, which data have repeatedly shown are safe and effective, reduce the severity of the virus and prevent hospitalizations in the rare breakthrough cases. Mark Pandori, the Nevada State Public Health Laboratory Director, has said that one factor in this breakthrough incident might be the Delta variant's heightened ability to avert immunity. Mark Pandori told the Review Journal, "The viruses that are circulating in July aren't the viruses that were circulating in February. These are the Olympians now." He added, "The ones that are circulating now have a better ability to get around vaccination." Concerns about the Delta variant of the coronavirus affecting people who have been fully vaccinated come as Nevada struggles to contain a rising cases. The Las Vegas Review-Journal notes on Tuesday, 13th of July, Nevada health officials reported 855 new cases, with the state's two-week positivity rate hitting 10%, a surge from 9th of June low of 3.3%. Brian Labors, an epidemiologist and assistant professor at the University of Nevada in Las Vegas School of Public Health, said that 60% of Nevada cases sequenced were now the Delta variant. Several weeks ago, the Delta variant comprised just 16% of sequenced cases. Brian Davis, the epidemiologist, added, Delta is clearly the dominant strain in Nevada, adding, over the past month, our numbers have been continually trending upwards, and the Delta variant is obviously contributing to that. Brian Labus noted that when you couple that with low immunization rates and our community being open 100%, you have the right conditions for that kind of COVID spread. Nevada health officials say that 46.01% of Nevadans aged 12 and older have completed vaccinations, and 54.46% have initiated vaccinations. According to health officials, this refers to the number of first doses given. According to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC, across the United States, 65% of those 12 and older have received at least one dose of the vaccine, while 56.3% are fully vaccinated. Brian Labus, an epidemiologist, says the rates we're seeing right now of vaccination are nowhere where we need to be to stop transmission. These percentages also fall far lower than what is probably required for herd immunity, a metric that has shifted upwards with the pandemic's continuation and Delta variant's ascent. Brian Labus added, this variant is probably pushing that number higher because it spreads much more easily. Meanwhile, the Nevada Independent reports younger Nevadans are the least likely to receive vaccines, presenting a challenge as they are most likely to be out and about. The website says only half of Nevadans aged between 20 and 59 have received their first jab, compared with more than 75% of residents aged 60 and older. In response, Nevada's governor, Steve Sisolak, announced on 1st of July that the state would seek help from the federal government, noting that the White House has announced its intention to send surge teams to hard-hit areas. A statement from Nevada Governor Steve Sisolak's office says Nevada is working with federal agencies to ramp up its initiatives to vaccinate more people. According to a report by the Nevada Hospital Association, there are a few positive signs. The increase seems to be contained to southern Nevada, which has the most medical resources in the state, and personal protection equipment supply flow is not in a state of chaos. The organization claims patients are less sick, seem to be spending less time in the hospital, and are not requiring intensive care or mechanical ventilation as frequently as in the past. The bad news is there is no current signal that indicates this news is slowing down, noting that the majority of the hospitalized patients are reportedly unvaccinated people.
Around the world with reporters.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years. Despite that, a number of international figures, including former US Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries,
It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European commissioner and foreign minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stopped their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report. It highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardments of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations, with Yemen's political leadership saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign